This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And get a copy of this book because it's intense, but it's really good. And as we said, the title of your book, Beg, A Radical New Way of Regarding Animals. So I wanted to start just with what is this radical new way of regarding animals, especially compared to our conventional way?
Well, it depends on where you are on your animal spectrum, how radical it's going to seem. When I was, let's see, maybe 18 years old or 19 years old, I had a humongous shift in how I looked at animals, how I saw the animals around me, how I saw the animals that I was using in my everyday life, but just had no idea. It just didn't really dawn on me. And I had a radical shift. And when I wrote Skinny Bitch, the intention was to sort of inspire and motivate that same shift in other people, and it worked. And I've gotten emails from thousands of people all over the world saying that they indeed changed their lives and don't see animals the same. And the hope with this book, Beg, is to inspire that shift again in regular people who are animal lovers.
Just regular people. And it seems like, and by the way, I want to let listeners know you can call in. Our number here is 503-231-8187 and talk to Rory yourself. But it seems that a lot of what your book was about, it was initially addressed to pet lovers. And it's sort of, it's this idea that there's a contrast between being a pet lover and an animal lover. And a lot of people don't even realize that.
It's true. And as a child, it's how I most identified myself was as an animal lover. But I never made the connection outside the animals that I lived with, the dogs and cats and birds, or the animals that I wanted, like a chimpanzee as a pet. It didn't occur to me that when I sat down to eat dinner with my family, who was also animal lovers, that we were eating animals or that on our feet were the skins of dead animals. So once I made that connection, I had to make a lot of changes. And some of them felt challenging, others felt easy, but overall, they all felt like the right thing to do because who was I? An animal lover.
And as an animal lover, specifically, an animal lover loves all animals is basically what you're trying to say?
I think that an animal lover does love all animals, but doesn't know it until they really are forced to look at it. And I think across the board, all the problems that we talk about when we're talking about animals and how they might be mistreated or neglected or harmed, it's not that humans are cruel or inherently mean. I think conversely, we're kind, we're generous, we're compassionate, we're merciful. We just have this disconnect that we don't know what it is that we're doing to animals because culturally and societally, it's been really easy to sort of brush a lot of it under the rug. And now we're the fish in the water who doesn't even know that there's water.
Right. And there is this kind of, I mean, it's interesting that the last show was about bullies because there is this way that we actually bully our animals we treat them as if they're like slaves or, you know, food or whatever. And yet a lot of people think that these animal lovers are just sentimentalizing things. And like, you don't want to get too sentimental. And what would you say to them?
I hear that every now and then. And people every now and then will suggest that we not anthropomorphize animals. But for the most part, I don't think that that's who animal lovers are. I mean, we exist by the billions. There are billions of us in the world who love animals and who don't want to see them harmed. And most of us, if we knew what it was that we were contributing to in our everyday lives and everyday actions, we would be horrified and we would try and help them and try to stop our own behaviors that are causing them this harm.
And you started the book a lot about your own dogs, which they sound adorable.
I think they are. Let's talk about them for the rest of the interview.
and basically, like, you know, so you're sort of like, I'm just dripping with love for your dogs by the time I've read a few chapters, you know. And then suddenly I'm getting into reading about puppy mills and humane societies, which end up euthanizing dogs and that kind of thing. And as much as you want people to rescue animals and puppies and things like that, one of the things I noticed, you don't want them to be rescuing them from like pet stores and things like that. And how do you rationalize that, or what's your...
Yeah, well, when people get dogs from pet stores, we don't call it rescuing, we call it purchasing. When they're buying animals from pet stores, that basically equals a dead dog in a shelter. In our country alone, every year in the United States, 6 to 8 million animals are going into shelters. Half of those animals are being killed because we don't have homes for them. And a lot of people are excited about the no-kill movement. Of course, it's a wonderful thing. That's saying that every single dog that goes into a shelter is going to be placed in a home. Without question, that's the model we all want to live up to. But it's not happening right now. It's not a reality at this moment. So the sad reality is that animals do need to be euthanized because we don't have homes. We don't have spaces in shelters to house all these 6 to 8 million animals. So they're getting killed. And instead of adopting these animals, we have breeders creating more animals. We have pet stores getting animals from puppy mills and people participating in this terrible cycle by purchasing these animals. So without question, one of the first things that humans can do as animal lovers is to adopt and not purchase.
And so when you see like a pathetic, sad little dog and you're thinking, oh, at least I could get this one dog saved, you're saying just hold that off.
I'm saying, yeah, unfortunately, we need to let one cycle of animals in pet stores not get purchased. Let these pet stores realize that their business is going to go out of business because nobody's buying, and let it stop.
And what about, there's this whole thing going on with puppy mills, breeders, and then, of course, the shelters. And there's actually, you have a very strong, strong distinction between puppy mills and breeders. And could you talk about that just a minute?
Well, puppy mills are places that if any one of us as animal lovers ever visited, or even people who don't love animals, would be horrified if we saw what goes on in puppy mills. Puppy mills are just large-scale breeding operations where the animal's well-being is last on the list and profits are first on the list. And breeders are small-scale breeding operations where profit and the animal's comfort are debatable depending on who the breeder is. Breeder really should be your last option. You can get purebred dogs at shelters. You can get mixed breed dogs at shelters. You can get old dogs, young dogs, puppies, special needs dogs. Every dog you could ever want in a shelter is available to you, and he or she will be the most loving and loyal, faithful companion.
Sounds like the right way to go. And I'm thinking that the main thing then is, as you said, all these animals end up in shelters and a lot of them are euthanized, but a lot of them also end up in research labs. And could you talk about that a little bit? Like, how does that
happen? That's another reason to adopt an animal. In some states, there's a practice called pound seizure that's legal.
Yeah, I read that it was 32 states allow that, right?
I'm not sure what the number is now since the book went to print. Uh-huh. But what happens is these labs are allowed to go into these shelters and purchase these dogs for just terribly low amounts. Not that it would make a difference if it was for $1,000. It's for, you know, a couple of dollars. They can purchase dogs or cats from shelters and then do cruel and deadly experiments on these animals. These are dogs and cats that used to be in someone's home or would be in someone's home and would be a beautiful and amazing pet. And instead, they're having electrodes, you know, put in their brain or other cruel and sick and deadly experiments being done to them.
Yeah, I read, like, you know, they have to drink alcohol, they have to inhale tobacco smoke, things that you'd think by now we'd figure out this isn't a good idea, even for people.
Yeah, it's like we already know that cigarette smoke is bad for us. We don't need to do any terrible, cruel tests on animals to get more confirmation of that.
Right, and a lot of these animals also end up dead dead and tortured, basically.
Yeah, I think probably dead is almost a better thing for them because the torture that they're living with and living in cages and being roughly handled and being terrorized their whole lives, it's probably, you know, freedom from this terrible body and life.
It's amazing. And another thing that I was really surprised at, when I go to movies, I guess I've always taken comfort in this idea that no animals were harmed in the making of this film that you see on the end of the... And this book, by the way, is just full of all these things you probably had no idea. And if you read it. So anyway, I learned that this is not necessarily the case. And could you talk about that just a little bit?
Yeah, unfortunately, what happens is this group, the American Humane Association, not to be confused with the Humane Society, the American Humane Association is funded, first of all, by the Screen Actors Guild. So it's not an independent organization. Second of all, they'll be on set with the animals and say, yes, this might be scary or this might be harmful. Sometimes that doesn't matter and the animal still gets killed. You know, we saw that in the HBO series Luck, which was about horse racing.
Right.
Three horses died in the making of that series. They finally canceled the series. In the making of The Hobbit, it was reported that 27 animals died. And one of the problems is they're Their reach only goes so far as when they're on set filming. It doesn't extend to how they're procuring the animals. It doesn't extend to how the animals are being housed or trained leading up to filming. And it doesn't dictate anything about what happens to the animals when filming is over. So if, let's say, like a chimpanzee is used in a film and then they're done filming and they said that on set everything was fine and the chimp was treated just fine, it doesn't say anything about how that chimp's going to spend the next 40 years of his or her life. What usually happens is the chimp spends the next 40 or 50 years of his life in either a roadside zoo or some concrete, barren, like, jail cell, basically.
And I was surprised, too, that trainers aren't necessarily compassionate, kind people with their own animals. I mean, that was like, shocking, actually.
I mean, anytime we're seeing animals used for human profit, there is the potential to see cruelty, neglect, and abuse.
Yeah, yeah. And so, for instance, some monkey in a Clint Eastwood movie was actually beaten.
Yes, it was reported in the LA Times. It was, I think, in a Jane Goodall movie as well, that the Clyde, the orangutan that was used in the Clint Eastwood movies that I watched as a child and loved, and it was one of the reasons I wanted a chimp as a child. This chimp was on set. He stole a donut from the craft services table. He was beaten with a pipe and died a short time later of cerebral hemorrhage.
That's amazing. I want to let listeners know you're listening to Rory Friedman. She co-authored a book called Skinny Bitch that put her on the bestseller list. She's recently written a book called Beg, A Radical New Way of Regarding Animals. And she'll be at Powell's tonight at 7:30, downtown Powell's on 10th and Burnside, if people want to see her. And As I went on through your book, of course, I mean, there was stuff about zoos and rodeos, hunting, fishing, fashion. One sort of shocking thing for me is I have all these merino wool socks, and I thought, well, that's, you know, I never thought of wool as a problem. I thought you just shear a sheep and it still gets to live and eat in its pasture. But could you talk a little just about that? Because that sort of surprised me, too.
Yeah, there's so much that we just don't know or that we think is one way and is another. And wool is one of those common ones that we think that what happens is the sheep needs us to shave him or her. We're doing them a favor. They would be so hot if we didn't. And what happens is these lambs are bred specifically to grow more wool than their bodies normally would. And in the case of the merinos, what happens is they're bred to have their wool grows in the wrinkles of their skin and on their skin.
So they have really wrinkly skin.
Well, they were bred to have more wrinkles because then if they had more folds in the skin, then more wool would grow. It's such a silly thing when you think about it. How much more wool are they going to get if there's wrinkles? But that's what these farmers were thinking of. So they bred them to have more wrinkles in their skin. And then what happens in these wrinkles is that moisture can build up. And then what happens with this moisture is flies are attracted to it. And then they can lay eggs there. Maggots can hatch. It's so gross. And then maggots can literally start eating the lamb or sheep alive.
Wow.
So in order to combat this, which is known as fly strike, these farmers are chopping off chunks of the flesh of these animals, hoping that when the scar tissue forms, it'll be less appealing to the flies. And this is merino wool.
Okay. I think I'm not using those socks anymore.
Well, it's okay to use them if you already have them,
right,
but we don't have to buy any more.
It's just amazing. And then, of course, there's what happens to not just sheep, but all farm animals. I mean, that was between the way they're raised and the way they're slaughtered. Oh, we do have one caller. Robin, would you like to ask your question?
Yes.
Go for it.
I don't know if you address this in your book, but I've volunteered a few animal shelters, and I think in our society, there's a lot of people don't even think about, like, the widespread life loss among animals, because I wonder if you'd address, like, how people are really caught up in which breed they like and this cool breed and that cool breed, and I don't think it even reaches, like, mass consciousness. Basically, how to just, you know, the more pressing issue in animal life. I think it's a really cultural kind of dominant approach that you're going to pick the dog that you like the best, and there's a lot of cronies, there's a lot of, like, favorites discussion, our culture seems to be a lot about that.
Well, it's sort of a lot about image of the dog as opposed to its actual little temperament or personality, would you say?
Yeah, and thank you, Robin, for calling and for bringing that up. And I think it is a good point. And, you know, one that I'm guilty of for sure in that we all have a type, I think. You know, so many of us are drawn physically to one type or another. And, you know, one of the things that I just have been doing on my book tour is I'm just curious what everyone else's type is. Like, I know which of my three dogs physically I'm the most attracted to. And I've been asking people to sort of vote because I'm curious what their type is. And I'm always shocked that everybody doesn't pick the one that I'm picking physically. But the good news is about shelters is that they have every single type, including purebred dogs. If people are really hung up on getting a purebred dog, 25% of shelter dogs are purebreds. So, you know, frankly, now knowing what I know, mutts are healthier than purebreds anyway, because when we have a purebred dog, then we have those breed specific ailments that breed has. But the mutts, because they don't have the same gene pool, are less likely to have those breed specific ailments. So really, it's a smarter thing. But I think, as you said, Stephanie, that the thing that we're really looking for is the temperament of the dog. We're going to be spending 15 years with this being. Isn't it going to be, it's like picking a car based just on looks or picking a partner based just on looks. Don't we want to be in love too?
Yeah, yeah. And to get back to, and we've got two more callers, but I want to get this quick question in and then we'll ask them what they want to say. Back to farm animals, something that was really getting to me is I've learned that we're starting to pass laws now that, I mean, a lot of why we know that farm practices are so obscene, basically, is because people have gone in there with video cameras, and that's starting to be against the law. I was reading that one group is trying to put people, they're trying to create the Animal and Ecological Terrorism Act, which would make it a terrorist crime to film what goes on in animals, with animals and farms.
The one that we're seeing now that's been popping up all over the country is the Ag Gag Bills, the one that we're calling the Ag Gag Bills, and this has been argued as just terribly un-American by so many groups, animal rights organizations, First Amendment rights groups, workers unions. Everybody's up in arms about this. And thankfully, the governor in Tennessee just struck down the bill that they were trying to pass because the attorney general said it was constitutionally suspect, which indeed it is.
Well, it attacks not only whistleblowers, you know, your right to speech, your right to, it's pretty incredible. But there are states that have passed them. Like I was reading that Iowa, Utah, and Missouri do have these laws on their books now.
It's pretty hideous to think that there's terrible, terrible animal cruelty that goes on all the time in slaughterhouses and factory farms, and that now somebody who goes in and documents this cruelty and alerts the public about what's going on
will be thrown in jail.
Is going to be imprisoned, but the people who are doing these things to animals or profiting off of these things are not going to be in trouble.
Yeah, it's
they're protected.
Yeah. So that's one more thing to fight against, apparently. And we have two callers. Sean, what was your question?
Hi, we're still in the teeth of the second Great Depression. So my question would be, we've seen the disappearance of the middle class, an increase in the suicide rate. Has there also been a massive increase in the number of animals that are being put down as a result of the fact that people just can't afford to have pets anymore? And also, do you have any response to Lair Keith's the vegetarian myth and this whole notion that so long as we have capitalism, which is based on consumerism, we're really not going to do anything for the planet or animals so long as we have this sort of a consumer-based society? Thanks.
Interesting. I'm not familiar with that argument. I would just disagree with it right off the bat in that, first of all, the number one cause of climate change is animal agriculture, and that beats out all of transportation combined. So, yes, we're still going to be a consumeristic society, even if we're a vegetarian society, but we've got somebody like Bill Gates even who's saying the future of food is plant-based food. We cannot continue the way we're going and expect our planet to survive when we are raising and killing 150 billion animals a year for food. It's just too damaging. It takes too many resources. It destroys too much land, and it emits too many greenhouse emissions. It's just not possible.
Yeah, I was reading sheep cause incredible soil deterioration. That was in your book. And the water used just for wool and for leather is poisoned with toxic chemicals, and there's tons of that being used. And, of course, all the methane gas that cows release, it's pretty incredible. And what was our other caller? No, no more color. Okay, great. So so basically, I mean, that's a lot. There's animal production and climate change are a huge link in your book.
They are. And you know, as I'm just sitting here thinking more about, you know, the question that was just asked, it's something I think we all need to, it's easy, you know, I'm asked a lot of questions when I'm on my book tour, like, what do you say when people ask this, or what do you say? And it's always these really broad things that kind of are outside the realm of what we can do. Like, can each of us control global warming, you know, as a big whole thing that's happening? No, it feels like it's an impossible thing. And it's a smart argument for somebody to make who doesn't want to make a change on their own individual behalf. But if we each do something that we can do, like, hey, you know, if I ride my bike to work instead of driving my car, that's better for the environment. If I bring bags instead of getting bags from the grocery store, that's better for the environment. If I don't eat animals, that's better for the environment. But to just say, like, well, we've got this big problem where we're all consumers, it's never going to fix the planet, whatever we do. It's like, that's just silly. That's like saying, well, I'm not going to do anything because I can't fix the whole thing all by myself. But we've seen time and time again, one person can make a difference.
Or what is it? Act locally, but also
think globally.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's very cynical to think that what you're doing is not going to make a difference.
And actually, that's part of what's going on. You said that this, you are a veganism yourself. I mean, you are into veganism, and you even have your animals eating vegetable products, right?
I'm vegan. I've been vegetarian for almost 20 years, 19 years, and vegan for 9 years. And it's been fantastic for me. It's just been great. And I'm not saying that every single person on the planet has to eat this way and those who don't are selfish and terrible. What I'm saying is I used to eat meat for every single meal. This is what I learned is what happens to animals that we eat. And I didn't want to contribute to that ever again because I'm an animal lover. And my job now as a writer of this book, Beg, is to let other people know this is what it looks like. This is the water. You're the fish. This is the water. We need to know what goes on.
We want to swim in different water.
Yeah, or just even know that we're in water. People just need to know.
Right.
And then
right.
From there, it's up to them to decide how they want to live.
And the book, a lot of it, as I say, it was hard to read, but because there were some really graphic, incredible things that, as I said, even shocked me, and I thought I knew a lot. But you said that, like, and we have just a few minutes left, but that this book sort of got you into a more spiritual focus with things, or you've gotten a more spiritual focus, and could you talk about that just a minute, and then why the title of your book is called Big?
Yes, well, there's linked those two answers. So I wrote Skinny Bitch, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, and obviously it's a profane title. There was tons of profanity in the book. And then I wrote this book. It had a different title and lots of profanity. And just before I was about to hand it in to my publisher, I was in a meditation retreat, and during a deep meditation, I had this thing happen to me that I wasn't looking for, that I didn't want. But what happened is, in the meditation, I knew I could no longer use profanity in my life or in my writing.
That's good on KBOO.
It's good all around. And what was just made clear to me is that the world is contaminated with so much anger and hate and hostility and profanity and promiscuity and duality. And I just didn't want to contribute to that anymore. And I just wanted to be more virtuous in my words and thoughts and actions and deeds. And I had to change the title. I had to take out all that bad language in the book. I called my agent and said, oh, you're going to kill me, but I don't want to hand the book in the way it is. And Beg was a title that came up during a meditation. Also, I just really got in touch with the grief that was in my body for these poor animals and what they experience. And it caught me off guard. I didn't know that grief was in there. I see a lot and I learn a lot. But I thought, like, well, I'm just going to try and help. And I didn't know there was all this grief. And I just really wanted to beg for mercy for these poor beings and just to beg my fellow animal lovers to read this book, get this information, maybe change some things in your life to help animals.
Yeah, I think that's a huge component of it. I mean, I think a lot of why we have our revulsion and our we don't want to even go there is because we're afraid of feeling the pain of that grief that if we were at all open, we're probably going to experience.
Yeah, I think it's very easy. You know, we plug our ears. Don't tell me, don't tell me, don't tell me.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, it's one thing, you know, I've been staying in hotels on my book tour, and my friends who are germophobic have been trying to tell me all the disgusting things I shouldn't touch in hotel rooms, why they're covered in germs. And I'm going, don't tell me, don't tell me. Because, you know, to a degree, there's nothing I can do about it. But with the animals, there's somebody on the other side of that don't tell me who's suffering.
Yeah.
So don't tell me is convenient for you, but really inconvenient for the animals.
Yeah, hugely inconvenient. So I just want to let listeners know again, I've been speaking with Rory Friedman. You're going to be, oh, and what's your website, Rory?
Oh, roryfriedman.com.
Roryfriedman.com. You can find out a lot of information and a lot of things to do, right, on this website?
Yes, thank you for reminding me. There's the Beg for Change campaign that's on my website. And it's just little fun, easy things that you can do every day for a month to become a better animal lover.
RoryFriedman.com. That's RoryFriedman.com. And Rory is going to be downtown tonight at 7:30 at Powell's. This will be talking about her book, Beg, A Radical New Way of Regarding Animals. Thanks, Rory, for being on KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm Stephanie Potter. This has been Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. The time is 9:29. Coming up next at 9:30, your host Paul Roland interviews Daryl Cherney, Earth First activist and producer of the documentary Who Bombed Judy Berry, about busting a myth about retired FBI agent Frank Doyle. At 10 o'clock here, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints. Join us at 11 o'clock for The Food Show.
Who was Harry Smith? To musicians, he was the man who created the Anthology of Folk Music in 1954. It set fire to the folk music movement of the 60s and inspired everyone from Bob Dylan to the Grateful Dead. To filmmakers, he was the man who made animation in the 40s by painting directly on film and who was in the middle of the avant-garde film movement of the 60s with Jack Smith, Andy Warhol, and the Kuchar brothers. Harry was a product of the Pacific Northwest, born here in Portland, and this Thursday, May 16th, the Oregon Cartoon Institute proudly presents the Harry Smith Seance at the Hollywood Theater. With live music and three projectors showing Harry's heaven and earth magic. That's this Thursday, May 16th, 7 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. And on Sunday, May 19th, it's the Harry Smith Free-for-All. All afternoon this Sunday, absolutely free, downtown at the Ace Cleaners. Co-sponsored by KBOO. More information at harrysmithpdx.wordpress.com.
Now Judy Berry is a wobbly organizer, a Mother Jones at the Georgia Pacific Mill. She fought for the sawmill workers hit by that PCB spill. T. Marshall Hunt's calling GP shots from Atlanta. Don Nelson sold in the Union long ago. Now they weren't gonna have no wobbly running their logging show. So they spewed out their hatred and they laid out their scam. Jerry Philbrick called for violence. Was no secret what they planned. So I ask you now, who bombed Judy Berry? I know you're out there still. Have you seen her broken body? Or the spirit you can't kill.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. My name's Paul Roland, the second part of Political Perspectives. And I have on the line Daryl Cherney, longtime activist with Earth First, and also ended up producing a film on the subject of the song you just heard, Who Bombed Judy Berry, which we'll be talking about. I interviewed Daryl a couple months ago when he was in town. He did a tour with his film, the film Who Bombed Judy Berry, about the 1990 car bombing of himself and Judy Berry, two Earth First activists. And as you heard in the song, Judy Berry was also an IWW organizer working to unite loggers and mill workers and environmental activists down in Northern California. And for that, she paid a price. And Daryl Cherney has a new effort here, which we're going to talk about. Hello, Daryl.
Hey, Paul.
Good morning. How's it going? Where are you at?
I'm in Humboldt County, California.
Right on. You've been there for a long time, huh?
I've been here for 27 years or so, yes.
Well, it's good to see some people sticking it out. Speaking of sticking out, you've really stuck with this long, long trial, long lawsuit effort to bring some accountability, rein in the FBI. And I really admire all the efforts that you and lots of other people, not just you, have put into this and attained some results, which we're going to talk about. So tell us what's going on most recently with this case.
Well, of course, we produced, I produced and Mary Liz Thompson directed a documentary, Who Bombed Judy Berry, which, by the way, whobombedjudyberry.com, is, you can get all kinds of information on it, just to put it out there. But in the making of that movie, we discovered a number of things. I mean, I pretty much knew about 95 or 98% of what there was to know, but there was a few new things that came about, and one of them was that the first FBI agent on the scene who blamed Judy and I for being the bombers was Special Agent Frank Doyle. We knew that. He was the chief of the Terror Division. What we didn't know was that when he retired, he got a job with Mythbusters television show as their resident bomb maker. He makes bombs on TV as a cast member for Mythbusters. And so that was interesting. So I went and purchased every single Mythbusters episode that Frank Doyle appeared on. And from there came some really valuable and interesting information because the legend of Frank Doyle, and by the way, the lawsuit had a number of names. One of the principal names of the lawsuit that we filed against the FBI and won $4 million for it, by the way, one of the principal names was Barry versus Doyle. So this is not a small character in our story. Doyle taught a bomb school 30 days before we were bombed in Humboldt County, California, where I live, is blowing up the insides of cars, highly unusual, even by his own admission. And by the way, when I say his own admission, we took days of depositions and days of trial testimony from all the characters I'm going to talk about. So this evidence is well documented in writing and under oath. So he was blowing up the insides of cars with pipe bombs on a Louisiana